Mammoth
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. Pop Hayden is a 19th century huckster, part snake oil salesman, part confidence man, part magician. He's also the creation of Pop Hayden, a performer whose School for Scoundrels has taught con games to willing students for the past two decades. What Pop doesn't know about the art of the con and the old American West, he'll probably just make up. This is Scammapalooza. So you have created an extraordinarily complex and detailed backstory for your onstage persona. Can you tell me exactly who is Pop Hayden?
Well, Pop Hayden, his history, he was born in 1849, and he was a preacher's kid and studied for the Episcopal ministry. He was from Tennessee. When the Civil War came, he was too young to participate in that. He had an incident in seminary at Virginia Theological Seminary in Alexandria. One of the daughters of one of the deans was involved, and he had to leave seminary in a hurry. And he ended up joining the Merchant Marines and traveling all over Asia on Merchant Marine ships. He changed his name. It was just easier than the whole family having to change theirs. And he became Pop Hayden. Well, he wasn't Pop at that time. He was Whit Hayden. And he was a con man. He came back after the ship. He'd gotten interested on the ships in medicines. He spent some time with shamans in the jungles of Malaysia and Indonesia and China, and had gotten involved in herbal medicines and stuff. So he became kind of a creator of patent medicines. At the same time, he was. When he came back, he got involved in with some men who were involved in con games and cheating at cards and stuff. So he was a card cheat and a con man, working with people like Canada Bill Jones and George Duvall, and eventually Soapy Smith and Doc Baggs. And when Soapy was killed up in the Gold Rush, he came back down and met Tesla in Colorado Springs, where he was living and had a laboratory there. And he's not much of a card player, Tesla. but they influenced each other quite a bit. Eventually, Pop took his medicine show to, in 1910, he was in, took his medicine show to a little town called White Horse Ranch near Landers, California. And he was going to build a big transmission tower for electricity, like Tesla had designed, there was something went wrong, and the whole little town and all the people in it got moved into the 21st century. They're still in the same locale, but it's like 90 years later.
And that's why we find Pop today in the 21st century still selling medicines.
Yes, trying to make a living. The only way he knows how is by selling medicine. And he can't do anything illegal now, especially because of, you know, he doesn't have very good documentation. He's an illegal immigrant in his own country.
Now, I've got to say, because now that I've heard the entire story, that a lot of that is true. A lot of that is, I mean, of course, it's completely true, 100%, but a lot of that is true to you as
well, the true thing is, I'm not really from the 21st century myself. That's the true thing. I'm actually from the 20th century, and I'm just trying to play catch. Well, yes.
Yeah, that is entirely true.
I'm trying to catch up and figure out what's going on and figure out how to make a living in this strange, brave new world.
I think that is true of probably most people.
I think a lot of people relate to the Pop Hayden character because of that.
Yeah, but you did. I mean, you did drop out of seminary college yourself.
Yes, I did.
Not under the same circumstances.
No.
And you did spend some time as a con man of sorts.
Well, I was never really a con man. I did the shell game on the streets in New York, but I didn't have training from con men. My training was all for magicians. I didn't know how to use shills. How to make real money off the shell game. It was basically, when I was doing it, it was really pretty much a fair game. Their eyes against my hands, you know. And I usually left the pee under the shells when they bet. You know, so they had an even break. They had a chance to win.
Can you explain the shell game, just in case there's anyone listening who's not familiar with it? How do you describe it to a layperson?
It used to be called Thimble Rig in England when it was first developed, and it was a miniature version of the cups and balls. What they did was they'd take three little thimbles and put a pea under it, and you would try to figure out which pea. They'd move the thimbles around. You'd figure out which one had the pea under it, you'd win.
That's obviously continued through.
In America, they took walnut shells and they created what we called a shell game.
Yeah.
Based on the same thing.
But today, most of the people that we see doing it are using, I mean, obviously performers and entertainers stick with the walnuts for the most part, but we see it with matchbox trays.
Matchbox and half a potato.
Half a potato, yeah. Mm. Those sort of things.
And yeah. Stuff you can throw away.
Yeah.
That's one of the things is they don't want to be caught with evidence.
Mm.
You know, you can, you know, and you don't want to have anything real expensive. If I got, like when I'm doing this trick, I have a $500 set of silver shells that I use when I'm demonstrating. I would never use those on the street and have to, I don't want to be caught with them.
Yeah.
That would be evidence. And I don't want to throw them away. So, you know, really on the streets, you want to be using something that is cheap and you don't mind throwing away.
And we should talk for a second about your shells, because they're absolutely beautiful. You ring them like a bell in the mm-hmm. middle of the show, and they sort of sound out across the theater. And they are worth
solid sterling,
and they are worth $500.
Yes.
And they're just one of the many sets of shells which you have sort of helped create or had created
mm-hmm.
For the School of Scoundrels. The same design that you've been using for a while.
When my business partner, Chef Anton, and I created the School for Scoundrels, we wanted our students to have some shells, and there weren't any really available at the time in the marketplace, and no good peas. And the way I had made my peas and shells, I carved real walnut shells myself and made the peas out of a pencil eraser, which I just cut all the corners off till it was a round pea. That was an extremely good pea, much better than the kind that magicians used at the time, because it didn't wear out and it would work on any surface. But to make those for other people would have been too much work, you know. So what we did was I made a set of shells, carved them with all the features I like so that they operate smoothly and makes it easy for me to steal the pea in and out of the shells. I made a shell that did that the best, and then we had those copied and duplicated by plastic and metal and, you know, other forms and cast. And so that way we could sell them at a reasonable price to our students.
I've been using the street shells for many years as my shells. I used to use the gold ones, which, which you've got, which I love because they're
pewter with gold plating.
Sorry.
Gold yeah, that's plated. What, no, but they are. We call them the golden shells, but they're actually pewter with gold plating.
Hmm.
And, we have copper shells that are actually just a different plating on the same pewter shell.
Yeah. I used to use the gold, but I found myself being overshadowed, by my props. People would be picking them up and say, oh, these are nice, and wanting to hear the story behind them. And I think I must have sent so many people to your website to tell them all about the gold shells, or come up with so many ridiculous stories about winning them in a card game, or they're my grandfather's teeth that I melted down, or whatever they are, that I ended up getting the much more realistic looking, street shells, which they're the sort of a resin, plastic.
They're plastic resin. They look like natural shells.
They do. Yeah. Very rarely do people accuse me of having fake nuts. That's
good. Yeah, well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, it's very good.
All the brass nuts, we also have brass ones.
Yeah. Oh, right.
I don't mind being accused of having brass nuts.
I should get myself a set of brass ones just for the joke.
Yeah, it's a good joke.
So you seem to have sort of picked a very specific period in American history. Like that seems like you're drawn to the late 19th, early 20th century.
It's a very fascinating time for me, both in magic and in the history of the country and the con games. And at that time, it was really the development of American marketing and modern advertising and science. It was going through an awful lot of changes at that time. So I find that everything we have in the 21st century is really pretty much mirrored at the same time period, at the turn of the 19th and 20th century. There was a lot of the same things going on and a lot of the same, it's very funny, but right now people are buying magnetized water and Amazing Miracle oils and crystals and magnets and all the kind of health crazes that were going on in the turn of the last century going on now.
Yeah. I imagine that 100 years from now, there's going to be a 22nd century magician who's doing an act which is a parody of, you know, Kevin Trudeau or one of those late night.
Well, it's also true that I found that, you know, it's hard to stay hip and stay current. You know, when I was a kid, I was always kind of like on a cutting edge, I felt like. When you hit 50, you aren't on anybody's cutting edge. You know, you're on the cutting floor, mostly. So to stay hip, rather than read all the magazines every week, I decided I would just go back in time and have a costume that was always appropriate, you know, because it's 100 years old.
Yeah, because as you know, I'm an author, and I finished the first book and put it out, and within a couple of months, there were things in the book which were out of date, and so it became a historical artifact just within a very short period of time. And I'm just tempted just to write historical fiction, set things in the 1950s or set things at the turn of the century.
Well, I have photographs. You see, I have photographs from every decade since the 70s, and each decade I'm wearing a different kind of tuxedo. And it's very obvious when the picture was taken.
Yes.
You know, and I wanted to avoid that as I get older. You don't want to, you can't really show an old picture of yourself if it's wearing an old tuxedo.
Yeah.
You know, because people go, that's an old picture. Look at that tuxedo. Well, what I found was by going back 100 years and wearing a 100-year-old costume, I can wear that the rest of my life. Nobody will know whether the picture is 10 years old.
That's right. So it's just another scam.
Yeah, it is.
Speaking of your costume, so can you describe it? I'll put a photograph up with the
sure.
with the podcast.
Well, I wear I originally started wearing a Western costume from the 1870s with a brocaded vest, very colorful brocaded vest, what a gambler would have worn in Deadwood, say, or in the 1870s. And I wanted to have a different look than everybody else. So everybody at the time that was doing a 19th century character or a magician or medicine show, they always used a top hat. They always had a top hat or a bowler. And I didn't want either of those. I wanted to be different. So I picked another hat that was popular, just becoming popular at the turn of the century, was the Homburg. So I decided on that. I didn't want to wear the old ties like they wore in the Civil War. I wanted to have something more modern.
Mm.
So I had chosen to use a regular four-in-hand tie. At that time, a lot of times they put tie pins in the knot.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. You don't see a lot.
No.
In movies and stuff. So I got a nice tie pin. It was a diamond and gold tie pin with a question mark that I set right through the knot of my tie. And wing collars. And then I had the vest. I got rid of the brocaded fancy vest and got a black plain vest so that my whole outfit is solid black and with a red tie. And that gave me more of a hard to pin down look. It wasn't dated to a particular decade. Somebody would have worn that suit from the 1880s up until the 1950s, really.
I think there's also in terms of, say, waistcoats, and in particular the pattern of waistcoats, mm-hmm. what people imagine people wore during that time changes, you know, throughout the years. So if you look at some of the cowboy movies from the 50s and 60s, their image of what someone in that era would wear has changed. Whereas you watch, say, Deadwood mm-hmm. today or any of those sort of movies and TV shows, our image of history changes.
Deadwood was fairly accurate to the clothing, I think, but that was the 1870s. You know, clothing changed in the 1880s and then changed again in the 1890s.
Yeah.
And I really wanted a look that was hard to pin down. I also wanted to, Citizen Kane is one of the characters that I think really represents the politician, con man, marketeer, you know, that I wanted to approach. So I decided on a costume that was kind of Citizen Kane looking. And this fitted perfectly.
You seem to, I mean, on the one hand, you've gone for a certain sense of historical authenticity with what you wear and what you say and how you act. Clearly know the era that you're trying to represent, but you don't seem stuck in it. You don't seem like you're, you know, worried too much if you've got props which are a little bit too modern, or perhaps there's something that doesn't quite work historically.
Well, that's part of the planning. We wanted to not be stuck, you know, having to use things from the 19th century. I wanted, because the character's brought into the 21st century, he's here now, and he's been here for some time. It gives me a lot of freedom. I've been here for almost 12 years now. First arrived in the 21st century in 2005. So I've had time to understand the internet, to catch up on history, know what I missed for the 95 years that I was gone. And I've pretty much caught up, and I'm not doing a medicine show like it was done in 1910. I've created a new medicine show for the people of the 21st century. It's geared to something that they would like.
At the same time, I noticed that the scenes you're performing all have a strong history to them. So you've got parts of your routine are all familiar to an audience. It's not that they've seen it before, but they feel like they've seen it before.
I've discovered that people all over the world remember the American West. You know, when I was a kid playing ninjas, there were Japanese kids playing cowboy.
<Yeah. laughs>
And that's kind of the way it is. The American West is part of everybody's heritage. Everybody plays cowboys, French, Italians, everybody, you know. So people are familiar with the medicine show character, and the Citizen Kane, the politician, marketeer.
Yeah.
And, these are kind of archetypical American characters in a way, and it enables me to satirize contemporary life by comparing it to the way things were done in 1910. It's a lot easier to see the con man when he's wearing an outfit that looks like a con man's outfit.
Yes, yeah.
And so I can point things out about politics. You know, when I run for president of the United States this year, you know, it will be as a con man, you know, as a cheat and an excellent marketeer. And I'll be able to satirize all the things that are actually being done, you know, from the point of view of a man from 1910.
I think the confidence man and the con artist, I think, is a great way of sort of holding up a mirror to various aspects of society, because they do rely on taking advantage of people's most, you know, they rely on taking advantage of our flaws, but also on our strengths and on our humanity. And mm-hmm. So being able to sort of tie into that and then twist it both as an entertainer and as a performer, it's a very powerful thing to be able to do.
Well, what really ties it all together is the trickster. Behind the con man, behind anybody that lives by their wits, behind the politician and the medicine show guy, the magician and the card cheat, all of these people they're various representations of the trickster archetype, you know, and the coyote and the fox and the raven and all the stories we tell about Brer Rabbit or you know, Brer Fox, every culture has this trickster character as part of their literature, because it's really how it's telling kids you don't have to be the strongest, you can be smart, you can survive by your wits. And sometimes the trickster character is just fun and full of joy and manipulating others just for the joy of it, like Bugs Bunny.
Mm.
And other times it's a real serious, dangerous character, you know, like in literature, Loki, you know, in Norse legends was a trickster character that was very dangerous and, you know, was trying to take over the world.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, I like by representing all the different natures, all the different trickster characters in one man, I've created a character that's endlessly fascinating for me to play.
Is there something almost Shakespearean about it? Because you look at Shakespeare and Twelfth Night or Midsummer Night's Dream, it's the clown or the trickster is always the one who's left standing mm-hmm. at the end and who gets to sort of make the final statement or
well, because
sum
he's not the important
events.
One usually. he's just the one that starts the process in motion and things go, whether they go his way or the other way, he's just kind of the catalyst.
Yeah, I think he's important, but it's never about him. Yeah,
because he's a kind of weird guy that we can't quite figure out.
Yeah, he's the one who sort of throws the match in and stands mm-hmm. back and watches.
Iago is a trickster character.
That's true.
Not
yeah.
a very pleasant one.
No, but yeah, that's right. Although he's more villainous, I feel like.
Prospero is a trickster character, but he's like almost godlike.
Well, that's, I mean, you as a magician and as a snake oil salesman are trying to be godlike in your own way.
Well, what I want to do, I mean, well, part of that is because people don't like being beaten by an amateur. It's embarrassing. But being beaten by a pro, being beaten by one of the best manipulators in the world, that's not so embarrassing.
Mm.
And they like to see how it would be done. Josh Billings, an American writer in the 1840s, says, people loves to be taken, but they wants to have it done by expert. And that just means that, you know, it's a good story if you got cheated at something by somebody who's really clever, by the real trickster.
Yeah.
And there's no shame. Anybody would have fallen for the same thing because he was so clever.
Yeah.
And so there's no shame. So it's a good story. But being taken by a 13-year-old kid, not so good.
Yeah, that's
he
right.
He wants to have it done by an expert. So Pop, by being the biggest expert he can, is the most enjoyable person to have actually take you to the cleaners.
And that's something you see with the, you know, I'm sure you've had it as well. You're performing the shell game at the Magic Castle where you perform on a regular basis, and someone will come up afterwards and say to you, oh, you know, I played that game on the streets of Paris or, you know, Barcelona or Vietnam or somewhere in the world. And they tell you the story with a sense of pride and a sense of the adventure of, I got taken, oh, and I lost, you know, and they'll take, oh, I lost $500, $1,000, $5,000 on this game. And very rarely do they seem upset about it in the same way as people who've been taken in some sort of investment fraud. And I think they do appreciate the skill and the trickery of it.
We see it's that story that people carry away. That's the magic story.
Mm.
When you do a magic trick, you create a story for the person you do it for. And that story is the story he tells to people afterwards. And a lot of times you can go to dinner on a good magic story. Ah, I saw the greatest magician in the world, and here's what he did.
Yeah.
And he did this, and he did that, and people go, no way, that couldn't happen. Oh, yes, it did. They said, well, it must have been this. No, it couldn't have been that. And finally they go, wow, I'd have to see that. And that's a story. I call that like a ghost story. It's a story that people don't want to accept. They go, no, that couldn't. I saw a ghost last night. No, you couldn't have. Yeah, I did. Well, you must have been drunk. No, I hadn't had a drop. You must have been asleep and dreamed it. No, I was wide awake, standing up. Well, somebody was playing a trick on you. I was in the middle of the woods. There's nobody out there. Nobody, you know, so magic story is the same way. People will argue with you about it.
Yeah.
The con man story is different. The con man story, I got taken to the cleaners at the shell game. Really? How'd that happen? Well, he was the slickest guy I've ever met.
Yeah.
You know, and here's what he did. And he said, do you know how he did it? Yeah, of course I know exactly how he did it. Well, how come you couldn't catch me? He was just so good. You know, there's no mystery. Nobody argues with it. It's like a Tiger Woods story. I played golf with Tiger Woods. Really? How was it? Did you win? Of course not.
Yeah.
Well, what was he like to play with? That's a good story. You know, same thing as I got taken by this con man on the streets in Barcelona, and he had half potatoes of moving them around, and I couldn't find this little rubber pea under him. And he took me to the cleaners. He was the best you've ever seen. Well, you know how he did it? Well, yeah, he was taking a pee out of one shell and putting it under another. I just couldn't see him do it. He was so good.
Do you think sometimes the people perhaps got swindled by a con man who perhaps wasn't that crash hot, but they like to tell the story where he's the, where they got taken?
Well, I think they wouldn't have gotten taken if he wasn't good enough for them.
That is true. I'm reminded of an episode of The Simpsons where Homer loses his house to a pair of carnies, and at the end, he manages to win it back by cheating them. And one of the con artists says, we were beaten by the best. And his son says, no, he didn't seem that good. We were beaten by the best.
That's like, exactly it.
Yeah,
that's the way the story has to go if it's going to be a good story to tell later.
Yeah, you don't want to be beaten by the okay or beaten by the second best. You want to be beaten by the top of the game.
You want to be beaten by the best.
I mean, you obviously perform these sort of, you know, you recreate the scams, I guess we'll say, in a show and in a performance. Do you ever have people wanting to gamble, everyone to put their money down on the table and play?
You'd be surprised. After I've taken everybody in the room and beaten everybody, there's always one guy that wants to play for money.
Yeah. Why do they do that? I can't understand it. I don't.
It's a competitive thing. Mm-hmm. You know, he thinks he'd get a really good story if he could beat the best guy in the world. You know, and of course, he ends up with the same story everybody else ever had.
Yeah, except it begins with him insisting on taking the money.
But actually, yeah, but you see, that's the whole thing. It's a magician friend of mine worked in a magic shop, and he said, oh, yesterday, these guys set up a 3-card Monte right outside the magic shop. And I just couldn't wait. I wanted to go over there and beat them. You know, I being a magician, I know how it's done. I could beat him. Oh. And I want to go out there and show him. And I said, well, they've already beat you. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, the hardest thing they have to do is get somebody to want to bet.
Yeah.
You're going out there wanting to bet. You're not going to win because they won't pay you even if you win.
Yeah.
They're just going to take your money. You're going to point to the right shell or the right card, and they're going to go, good on you, sir, and walk off with your money. And you can't chase them because there'll be three or four guys you'll be tripping over.
Yeah.
You know,
so I think that's the thing. There's that people think that the idea is that you're supposed to win the game. But you're not supposed to try and win the game. You're supposed to win the money. And that's an entirely different thing. You know, you can win the game. You just can't get the money.
The con man has no ego. He's there just to make money, and he doesn't care how he does it.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, especially with these gangs of men that were trained by professionals back in the 1800s up until the 1970s, these people had it down so well that they never had to beat anybody up. They never had to resort to violence to get the money. They would get all the money, and they would guide the guy out of the situation and take care of him, cool him off. Everything was done smoothly because every detail of this script has been put in place over a period of several hundred years since the days of the Spanish Armada. And so we're dealing with a script that's been the longest running and most successful play in history. And these guys knew it perfectly. Today, they learn the game in pieces in prison. They learn how to make the moves. They learn how to take the money. But they don't have every detail. They don't learn the whole scam the way a mob was trained in the old days. So they will resort a lot of times to violence if they can't get your money any other way. If you complain, they knock you down.
Yeah.
There's six guys there and just one sucker.
Yeah, it's just a way to find out who has cash.
Yeah.
It's a little like, I guess, in Stockholm, the pickpockets always hang around where the people playing, the shell game are because they can see people reaching for their wallets. Even if they don't bet, they're patting their pockets and,
On the racetracks, the pickpockets used to have somebody go, somebody just stole my wallet.
And everybody
reaches for the wallet, yeah. So the pickpockets know where they are.
there's some guys who play the shell game, and they play it on the ground. And the idea is that if you want to bet, you're meant to sort of put your foot on one of the shells, and that's great because it stops you from turning it over yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll come down. And so they've got distance, and it also means people have got to come in, but it also means that pickpockets can sort of come up and tap people on the leg, go, no, 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 put your leg on. And the shills
can talk to the spectators. And because the other guy has his head down low to the ground, the con man supposedly, he can't hear what the shills are saying.
Yeah.
So it creates a fake distance between the shills and the spectators and the con man. The con man wants to be blind and deaf. The spectator has to think he's blind and deaf. Otherwise, how come he can't see the corner of that card is bent? How come he doesn't know that he flashed that P under the shell? You know? So in order to create that, there's always got to be some way in the script, in the play, that explains that. In the Cracker Parker mob in London, they would do it with Coke-rimmed glasses. The operator throwing the three cards would have glasses thick as bottom of a Coke bottle, and he couldn't see. He'd have to hold the cards up 2 inches from his face just to tell what the card was, and he'd check that way. And he'd have a hearing aid, and if somebody said something to him like, oh, the card is bent, he'd go, what? It's not a bet till you put it on the table.
Yeah.
You know, and by pretending to be blind and deaf, he also created another problem for himself, morality. The spectator would, the victim would feel sorry for him and not want to bet. So he had to, after he got the guy in and explained why he couldn't see and hear what was going on, and he still had to make this honest person, this good Joe, want to take advantage of a blind and deaf man. So he'd have to do something else in the script to create that situation. He would usually say something insulting. Don't throw your money at me, sir. Play nice or not at all, because this is an illegal game. We can be arrested. You know, we don't want to draw attention. No fighting. If you don't play nice, if you're not having fun, go away. We don't want you. You know, and that would make you feel, what?
Yeah.
I didn't do anything. I just put the money down.
I've lost money on Bon Two in France, and I feel guilty. for losing my own money. Like I've chosen the right one. They've done some, you know, they've done like a double hype move and swapped out the winner and then basically called me an idiot. And I felt bad as if I've done something wrong, despite the fact I knew I was right. I know what they did to cheat me, but the character was so strong that my first instincts were to.
They want you to feel bad about yourself.
Yeah.
So that you don't go to the cops.
Yeah.
Most people don't go to the cops because they feel stupid. Or they feel like they were trying to take unfair advantage. If this comes out in court that I was trying to rob some poor blind and deaf guy.
Yeah.
You know, that's not going to look good for me. So they'd rather tell the story. This guy just took me to the cleaners. He was so clever.
Yeah.
They don't ever mention it. I saw the card was bent.
It's like they're trying to find this middle ground where they don't go to the police, but do go to the ATM. That's the, you know, you don't want to beat them so bad that they don't come back. You want to walk away and maybe I should go get some money and come back and try another time.
But that's the smoother's job.
Yeah.
You know, the smoother will tell him, you know, oh, they took me the same way last year. You know, don't go looking for them. Don't go get the cops because you were gambling same as them. If you tell the cops you were betting money on this game, you were gambling. That's illegal. They could put you in prison the same as them. So, you know, these guys are mean too. They'll put a knife in you.
Yeah.
They're dangerous characters. So don't go back there. Best thing to do is write it off. You don't have any money, do you? You probably don't even have fare to get home. Here's £5. You know, go get a cab and go home.
Yeah.
Write it off as a lesson and a good story you can tell your grandchildren.
Yeah.
They actually set it up that way.
It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And you go, oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. That's part of it.
But that's a good professional gang. From the old days, not the way they do it all
the
time.
No, well, in America, I mean, in Europe, the gangs are a lot older. They're all in their 60s and 70s. And even, you know, like I've seen some 80-year-olds out there doing it. But
they're not trained by the professional guys that they used to have. Don't have the depth. They don't have the complete game.
No, they don't. But they do have smoothers and they do have, you know, lookouts and they do have the various roles. Yeah. Yeah, it matches everything, but there's a certain nastiness to it that I may be romanticizing history, but there's a nastiness to it when I watch them play.
Even in Soapy Smith's day, you know, there was nastiness.
Yeah.
Remember the thing that got Soapy Smith killed was when somebody swindled, this guy named Stewart out of his poke, a $9,000 gold poke, and, knocked him out. You know, they mugged him, or, you know, he claimed that they had. But in reality, I think he probably just got his money lost and turned it into a robbery when it was what they would claim a fair game.
Yeah. There is always this idea, and I think as throughout the 20th century, we've turned the con man from a criminal into an anti-hero. And we talk about the con man as, you know, and the magician as a trickster. Do you think that we have, to an extent, sort of romanticize them a little too much?
No, I don't think so at all. I think, you know, there is something wonderful about the trickster, even the most devious and the most dangerous trickster. It is something worth celebrating. We celebrate them for their cleverness, not for their cupidity. You know, even Jesus was admiring of a clever thief. You know, he admired him not for his theft, but for his cleverness. And he says, why can't you Christians be as my followers? Why can't you be as clever as that thief? You know? And I go, that's probably what it is. You know, as we don't have to celebrate the guy for his lack of morals. We probably look down on him and we don't encourage people to be like that. But we might encourage for people to be smart like that.
Yeah. Talking to Glenn Hester, who's a, you know, carnival cop and used to shut down crooked carnival operators. In one breath, he would be, you know, decrying these awful, terrible carnies and their evil, wicked ways. And then in the next breath would be, admiring them for the.
Well, he's friends with all of them.
That's true. He is friend, yeah.
He might be putting them in prison, but they're on good terms personally.
Yeah.
He likes them and, you know, respects
them. And learns from them.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And he would be, you know, explaining some extraordinarily complex
thing. He's always been very nice to me.
despite your criminal history.
Yes.
You gave him a few free bottles of magnetized water. On the magnetized water, can you explain exactly what that is? The whole, not just in the show, but just because you've made magnetized water.
Well, you can look magnetized water up on the internet. You can go on the online and plug in magnetized water. You'll get hundreds of articles and websites and stuff all about magnetized water. And it's a scam, and it's been going on for hundreds of years. You can buy bottles of magnetized water or radium water, you know, from the 1890s, or electrical oils or electrical water. There's an electrical water company. What was the name of one? I have a fake website called the electricwaterbc.com. And it's a electric water bottling company from Schenectady, New York. And it's based on a real bottling company, and it has, you know, the fake history with Pop Hayden is behind it, but as if it was still in operation in the 21st century. So, Pop, you know, selling magnetized water, to me, I'm making fun of it because it's the kind of fake science that was so prominent in 1890s and 1910 and is really prominent again now because of the New Age movement and other things where people have gotten interested in alternative therapies and medicines and stuff, and it's brought them back all the same kind of things that were popular in the turn of the century, you know, magnets, crystals, all these electric waters, magnetized water, and so on. So I like bringing these things up and reminding people that this existed. And just by associating it with somebody they know to be a con man, I feel like I've done a public service. If they think magnetized water and see Pop Hayden's weird face, you know, they go, oh, yeah, con.
Yeah, and you do it in a way in which you never, I mean, you sit there for 15 minutes, and you can go to your website. This isn't just a part of your show. There's a website you can go to, and
we have videos with scientific experiments demonstrating. You know, like, I try and demonstrate every.
Yeah.
I try and prove it. It's real in as many different ways as I can.
Yeah.
But it becomes more preposterous and unbelievable the more it's proved.
Yeah, and more unconvincing as it goes on. You know, the more proof you provide, more the audience.
The more they go, this is fake.
The audience is sort of listening politely, and then they start to giggle and titter. And towards the end, as your proof becomes, you know, you're jamming a spoon into a cup, and it's getting stuck because the magnet of water is too strong.
Well, I take the bottle and stick it against the refrigerator. It sticks.
And it sticks, and then you become, you know, the more proof you provide, the more ridiculous it becomes, and the whole thing falls apart.
This is magnetized water.
Yeah, that's right. And so you can't
put it in a steel cup.
Yeah, and without ever sort of offering any sort of real criticism of magnetized water, you do the opposite, and yet people come away.
Well, my new act is even more fun. I'm doing phrenology now. I'm a practitioner of the science of phrenology. And that was a whole bunkum science made up in the 18... Well, it was originated in 1790 and became very scientific. It was very scientific up until about the 1850s. And then new things came in and it kind of lost credence. But it became... a popular parlor game and a scam that people did is kind of like palmistry or astrology. People would set up parlors and do readings of phrenology up until the 1950s. But it's totally meaningless, and we can prove that it's not real and it couldn't possibly be true. But Pop, I take it and I prove it's real. I read people's heads, and I can tell them exactly what object on the table belongs to them. You know, just by reading the bumps on their head. Of course, I cheat. But I always try and prove. I try and prove the fake thing and the impossible thing, and then let people know just because it looks like he proved it doesn't mean it's true. Because he's a con man. He's a cheat. He's a magician.
Okay. If you think that, you know, if Pop was born in the, you know, now, today, what do you think he would be selling in his show? What modern thing do you think would most sort of tickle him and most attract him, do you think?
Oh, the same things they were selling before. Some kind of gasoline additive to make the carburetor run better.
Yes.
I might have a foot bath you can put your foot in, and the toxins will be removed. It'll pull the toxins right out through the skin of your feet, all the toxins in your body. And you can see it happening because the water starts turning black or brown.
Yeah. It would have to involve toxins or neurotoxins.
Neurotoxins, yeah. You can remove. Of course, you know, lead and other toxins are too big to go through the pores of the skin.
Yes. So but, doesn't shush, quiet, quiet.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got it. I think he would be sad because obviously, as you know, vaccines cause autism, which has been scientifically proven by a fraud. And there's a whole lot of problems with vaccines. So what if Pop has a vaccine that will protect you from vaccines?
Yeah, something like that. It'd be very clever.
I think you'd get some, yeah.
But basically, whatever Pop would take whatever people are interested in and try and sell them on their own bias confirmation. He's going to try and prove to them these kind of like weird ideas they've heard and thought sounded kind of interesting. Wouldn't it be nice if there was something that would remove all those toxins from your skin? You know, they want to believe that, and then you provide it, and with evidence to prove it works.
Brilliant. All right. Just to finish up with, I have a thing I call the con man's dictionary, in which I give you an obscure phrase or terminology from the world of the con artist or the swindler, and then you've got to try and guess what it means or just make it up. Mm-hmm. I like to put people on the spot in that way. I realize it's going to be very difficult because you're quite well read, not just in con man history, but in general history. So I'm going to go deep and hope you haven't read my blog and go with the wolf in the breast. Do you know what the wolf in the breast is?
No, I've never heard that term.
Do you have a guess for what it might be?
No, I don't.
No guesses?
No guess.
It's a fantastic 17th century scam in which women would sit on the side of a road, and as a gentleman would ride past, they'd start clawing at their chest as if they had some sort of heart palpitation. Some describe it as a literal wolf inside their chest trying to claw themselves out, and they'd sort of pull their bodice down and reveal their cleavage and say, you know, you must help me. There's a beast within my chest trying to escape. And the man would be so overcome with, either lust or embarrassment. Or charity, of course. His judgment would be clouded, and he would help the woman in any way he possibly could, and they'd end up being swindled.
Yes, well, I could understand why I would never have actually used or heard.
It's such a ridiculous idea.
Well, yeah. It's not a scam that would work for me.
No, it would for me, because yeah. I've got a, you know,
a lovely set of...
A lovely set. They're a little hairy, but once I hit the gym and you know, nice wax there, I will be swindling passing.
Well, it's a better time. You'd probably find a lot of men that would stop to help you.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and the beard was very fashionable for the ladies at that time as well. It would have done very well. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
Fantastic.
It's always good to see you, Nate.
Lovely.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.